It's the weekend, and you have financial questions that need answering. That can only mean one thing. It's time for Jill on Money, the show that takes the mystery out of your finances. Here's your host, Jill Schlesinger.
Welcome to your President's Day weekend, ladies and gentlemen. It is so exciting. I'm always excited in the beginning of the year. I don't know about you, but because my schedule is pegged to the New York Stock Exchange schedule, I love the first 2 months of the year because there's all these Mondays where you have a day off. And the radio stations always get a little mad at me because they're like, well, we're on the air. I'm like, yeah, market's closed. Sorry. See you next Monday. So hopefully you have Monday off because that's such it's a needed thing here in February. All right. We have a very special break from tradition here. And it's only because I love this guy so much that we're starting the show with a guest. You know, usually we start the show with you. And don't worry, we still are going to do that. It's just that this guy is so important that I wanted to kick the show off. And you'll hear why this is also incredibly self-serving. But we'll get to that in a second. If you've got a financial question, give us a call, 855-411-JILL. We'll get you on the air live. You can also send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. Follow us on Twitter. And now let me introduce, without further ado, the great, the most, actually, I think it's his second, maybe his third time, the most important guest of the hour, maybe the only one, Kevin Keller, CFP Board Chief Executive Officer. Kevin, welcome to Jill on Money. How are you?
Jill, I'm great, and happy President's Day to you. I'm standing here in my office.
Yeah.
Looking out over the White House.
Oh, so, you are. Yeah, you're amazing. I always forget that you're in D.C. And of course, let me also wish you a belated happy Valentine's Day. Anyone who listened to our previous interview with you, which must have been now a few years ago, knows that essentially I was interviewing you and looking you up at the same time to look at your picture. And in the middle of the interview, I said, oh, my God, you're so handsome. Do you remember that?
I do. You're so kind.
And he really is.
Wash.
Now, Kevin, also, let me ask you another question. What does CAE after your name? Your title, CFP Board Chief Executive Officer Kevin R. Keller, comma, CAE. What does CAE stand for?
Well, Jill, you're a certified financial planner.
Yeah.
And that is the professional designation that you hold.
Right.
For those of us who manage and lead nonprofit associations, there is a certification, and it's a certified association executive.
Oh, I like that. I also like the idea that it has executive in your name, which is fantastic. Okay, now, the reason why Kevin is here is that we have an exciting, we announced something pretty exciting during the week to formalize our love affair. And it is not that we're getting married, because that's not in the game plan for either of us. But Kevin, I don't know if I should say it or you should say it. Do you want me to say what the big announcement is, or should you say it?
Well, I'd be happy to. I'm honored.
Okay.
To make the announcement.
All right, you make it.
Jill, we couldn't be happier that you will become CFP Board's senior ambassador, the senior CFP Board ambassador, and become the public face of CFP certification.
Oh, my God. Clap, clap, clap. Thank you very much. Okay, now let me just give you a little inside scoop, listeners. If you could have only seen the various list of names that we were trying to come up with for the title of this, which, I mean, it literally at some point I just said, I'm really okay if you just say Kevin's girlfriend. Like, if that's the title, we could not decide. But this is why I love the title. Which, by the way, my significant other came up with. I don't know if you know that, Kevin, after all is said and done.
I didn't know where it came
from. Yeah. So all that money that we've been thinking about spending and time and energy and agencies and all of that, I just said, honey, what do you think? And this was the title. There is actually something called a CFP ambassador. It's a group of the CFP professionals from around the country, and they work on the ground with their local communities, and they promote financial planning and why working with a CFP professional is so important. And so it's almost like I get to be the quarterback of that team and then some. So that's why I love the title. And anyone who's listened to this show, you know that I don't really need to maintain this CFP designation anymore, because in my current role as a media person, I don't really need it, but I cling to it. You know why, Kevin?
Why is that? Well, one, it was so hard to get.
That's exactly right. I will never sit for that test again. But, you know, I was writing about this. I was just writing my article for Tribune, and I was, you know, I wrote about this, and I've spoken about this before, that this was a really important step for me to take as I left the world of Wall Street as a trader and went into financial planning, because I felt that earning the CFP designation really was not just a badge of honor, but it meant something because of the amount of time and energy it takes to get it, but also the substantive analysis that it allowed me to now kind of bring to a client relationship. And, you know, Kevin, if people don't really understand how much it takes, what exactly does it take to become a CFP professional?
Well, Jill, you talked about how proud you are to have earned CFP certification. I've had accountants, CPAs, who obviously have passed a very difficult exam, who ultimately go on to become CFP professionals, tell me that it was a more difficult exam than the CPA exam. So I don't know if that's true for everybody, but certainly it is a rigorous exam. But the exam is really the culmination. You know, we start with education, and it's the equivalent of six upper baccalaureate level or master's degree classes that a CFP professional. That's even before the exam. There is an exam that is, you know, six and a half, 7 hours long. 40% of the people who take it fail. These are not stupid people, but it is that difficult, that rigorous.
That's actually improvement, because when I took it, I remember it was like a 50% failure rate.
55. So it's inched up a little, but not too much. We require 3 years of experience, or, you know, 2 years if somebody's working directly for a CFP. And then there's, and I think this is one of the most important parts, there is an ethical evaluation as well. You know, there are, I think, almost 200 designations, Jill, in the financial service. This alphabet soup goes on for days.
And
they all have a code of ethics, and it's all high-sounding and sounds really important. And yet, for almost all of these designations, you know, there really is no enforcement, or there's no meaning behind it. So we talk about the four E's.
Hold on, before we do the four E's, we got to pay some bills. So we're talking to CFP Board Chief Executive Officer Kevin Keller, CAE, Certified Association Executive. When we come back, Kevin's going to talk more about what it takes to become a CFP and what the professional mark means and what I'm going to do for him. So you're listening to Jill on Money. We'll be right back.
From rookie investors to savvy veterans, Jill Schlesinger is here to help you. Call now, 855-411-JILL, or email askjill@jillonmoney.com.
You're back with Jill on Money, and we're talking to CFP Board Chief Executive Officer Kevin Keller. And Kevin is nice enough to invite me to become the new Senior CFP Board Ambassador, which basically means I'm going to maybe be talking a little bit more on other media outlets. You might see me talking about issues surrounding the CFP designation and what CFP professionals do. And Kevin, before we went to the break, you were about to tell us about the four E's, the pillars of the certification. What are those four E's?
The four E's to become certified are the education, which is a bachelor's degree at a minimum, six upper baccalaureate level additional classes, and a commitment to continuing education. The second E is the examination, a very tough, very difficult exam. The third E is experience, 3 years of experience. And then the final E is ethics. Those are all the what of certification. But, Jill, I wonder if maybe we shouldn't talk a little bit about why CFP certification is so important.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm going to tell you my personal experience, and then you tell me if it's reflects what you've seen among CFP professionals. I mean, first of all, I came in as a career transitioner. So I came from a trading background. I didn't really understand the nuances of estate planning or risk management in terms of insurance and even fundamental tax issues. I had a basic understanding. I didn't have a professional understanding. And so for me, sitting for the CFP exam and going through the process was a way to educate myself about a more holistic approach to dealing with clients and feeling legitimate in many ways. So that's why I did it. Why do you think more and more we're seeing, you know, almost how many, 75, 78,000 CFPs now?
Yeah, we're almost at 77,000. You know, traditionally, people who work with clients have provided investment advice, and certainly that's very important. But a person's financial life is so much more complex than just the investment advice. You mentioned the estate planning, the retirement planning, tax planning, insurance. These are all important, and, you know, they make CFP certification makes an individual a much more well-rounded and, I think, valuable advisor to their clients.
Yeah. And you know what? I think that so often people are dealing with financial professionals and they think that's what they're getting. And what the one thing I will toot your horn is that I think, especially, of course, you know, the designation's been around a long time, but even in, say, the last decade or since the financial crisis, it has become a really important way to judge what kind of professional am I dealing with. If I'm a public, if I'm sitting out there in the public, I have to learn the difference between a salesperson and an advisor. And one way I can figure that out, I'm not saying that we're not all in sales. People in this business are in sales. They have to make a living. But that they feel like they're really talking to someone who can take a look at their full financial picture and provide advice. And I think that's a part of it that seems to me not only well-rounded for the professional, but for the client experience.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, Jill. But, you know, one of the reasons I think CFP certification is so important for your listeners, you know, financial services, let's face it, it's an awful reputation that people in financial services have. The Edelman Public Relations Firm, they have this trust barometer every year. Financial services is at the bottom of all of the various professions and industries, and that's why, you know, the public just doesn't know where to turn. You know, the business that we're in at CFP Board is really public assurance, is assuring the public that when they see those three letters after a person's name, that that individual is committed to delivering ethical advice and that, you know, that they are well-trained in across the board in financial services.
Before I let you go, because I know you're super busy, you know, figuring out how to storm the White House in some way and shake the president and reinstate the fiduciary standard. can you give me a 2-minute position on the CFP board's analysis of the Trump administration's potential desire to roll back the implementation of the Department of Labor rule that would require institutions and the people representing those institutions to put their clients first, or the fiduciary standard? Can you give me a 2-minute on that?
Yeah, let me just, I think you have to go back. The fiduciary standard for retirement plans came about in 1974. There were no 401ks, only a little bit of IRA money. And so otherwise, it was the traditional retirement plan, and there's always been a fiduciary standard for people participating in the in a traditional, what we would call defined benefit retirement plan. But along, you know, we've had a huge transformation. People's, most of people's wealth, many people, a good portion of their wealth is in either their 401k or their IRA rollover. And the Department of Labor, beginning in the last administration, rewrote the rule to close loopholes, if you will, that allowed advisors to give something other than, something less than, fiduciary advice for 401k IRA plans. And so that's what, that's the background. Look, this has been really disruptive for firms. Let's not admit, it's been a huge challenge for firms to get ready for it. Mm. But they're almost there. The rule was supposed to go into effect April 10th of this year. And now I think one of the unfortunate things of the actions they've taken, there is, you know, there is uncertainty, if you will, for
right.
firms, and uncertainty for clients about whether or not whose interest the advisor has at heart.
And, you know, and everyone who listens to this show knows that I have beat my chest about this, because I think it's important to say that the majority of financial professionals out there are not, like, I know these people. They are not trying to rook you. But what you just want to know is that they're on the same page as you are. And so I don't want to make it sound like, you know, oh my God, the only person that is going to actually treat you well is someone who is held to the fiduciary standard. But it just makes it easier for the public, Kevin, that I think that's the issue, that they don't have to guess, or they presume that someone is acting in their best interest, but that person may not be. And so what is the best way, if someone's listening to this, to feel like, okay, how do I know if someone's putting my interest first? Just ask?
I think, first of all, ask, are we going to be in a fiduciary relationship? And listen very carefully, because we've heard examples. We heard an example once where somebody said, well, you will only need a fiduciary if you're infirm or you're not of sound mind. Mm. That is not the case. You want to be working with a registered investment advisor, or you want to work with a NAPFA fee-only advisor, or you want to be working with an individual who will commit to you. We at CFP Board are business model and compensation neutral, but you want the commitment that you're going to be in a fiduciary relationship.
And that is all there is to say about it. Kevin Keller, CFP Board Chief Executive Officer, and now I guess my quasi-boss, now that I'm the new senior CFP Board Ambassador. I have to answer to you now, mister. Thank you so much for joining us today. You're the best. The best. It's fantastic. All right. That's the show for this moment. Okay? We're going to come back to your calls, your questions. It's Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL. Go to jillonmoney.com if you want to check out any other past episodes. All right, your questions coming up next. Thanks again, Kevin Keller from the CFP Board. We'll be right back.
K, IRAs, refinancing. She covers it all. Back to Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger. Broadway is
dark tonight. You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, we'd love to hear from you. Our phone number here is 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. Hey, Mark, did you watch any of the Grammys? No, not too much. I don't know anyone either. Well, I tell you who I did know. I knew Adele and Beyonce, so there's that. I love Adele. I didn't know I loved her until I saw her in concert. Then I loved her. So I wish they could both win. I want everyone to win. It'll be like Little League, where everybody gets a trophy. Anyway, hey, if you want to come join us here, give us a holler, 855-411-JILL. send us an email, follow us on Twitter, and don't forget, check out our new podcast, Better Off. You can get it on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, SoundCloud, anywhere else that you find. I don't know if there's any other place to find your favorite podcast, but I think that'll about do it. Let's talk to Rosalba from New Jersey. Welcome to Jill on Money. How can I help you, Rosalba?
Hi, Jill. Good morning. How are you?
Great.
My question is, I bought a house back in 2002, and because things were not going like well, I got into a second mortgage, a home equity mortgage, and I have been having some issues with the house because what happens is sometimes my the house is rented. I moved there for a year, and then I moved back to New York, and I rented a house, but sometimes what happens is like my tenants moved or things break and, you know, I don't have a lot of cushion to support sometimes the expenses.
Okay.
And sometimes I think about selling the house. I have a company that helps me with like the maintenance of the house, a realty company.
Okay.
And sometimes like I ask them, is it okay to sell now? They tell me, well, it's not, the market is not as great as it should be. So my question is, like, should I sell this house? Should I keep it? The mortgage is not that bad, the payment, but adding that other mortgage, that's, like, kind of the issue. It becomes an issue sometimes for me to keep it.
So how much is, again, I know this is, you haven't actually gone and done this officially, but what would you guess the house in Florida is worth?
Well, I asked them a few weeks ago, and they said it ranges between 150 and 160.
Okay.
And I kind of, like, did a research myself, and it's within, yes, they were right, it's within that price.
How much do you still owe on the first mortgage, the primary mortgage?
79.
And what? How much on the second mortgage?
40,000.
Okay. And if you looked at it, like if I looked at your tax return, right, you're claiming it as rental property, right?
Yes.
Okay. So between the tax deduction and the rent and all that, are you breaking even? Is it costing you money? Is it making you money? Where do you stand with it?
Right now, like I'm not really losing anything. I'm just like kind of even.
Okay. You don't think you'll actually go down and live in that house eventually?
I don't think that'll happen.
Okay. All right. That's okay. I just want to make sure. And what was the purchase price of the house?
We bought it at $109,000.
Okay. So let's talk about this a little bit. And if you have this kind of a rental property, when you sell it, there may be a little bit of a tax hit for you. Now, I say that maybe because it kind of depends whether you put money into the house. Did you buy it and just rent it out immediately? Did you put some money into it? Did you fix it up a little bit? Is there a way to maybe assume that your cost basis is more than that $109,000 that you paid for it?
No, actually, we didn't fix anything, and we didn't rent it right away, but we like a year after we bought it, we rented the house.
Okay. And if you were to sell it, what happens is with a rental property, there's kind of two parts of the tax. One is a capital gain, and again, because this was treated as rental property, and not your primary residence, you have to pay capital gains tax on it. But what I would suggest is this. It sounds to me like you probably should sell this house. Before you do, I'd love for you to talk to an accountant, a CPA, who can help you figure out just how much money you would have to pay in total taxes. Do you do your own taxes or do you have an accountant?
No, I do have an accountant.
Okay, so go to the accountant. This is what I want you to do. Go to the accountant, say, we're thinking of selling Florida. Here's what we bought it for. You've done our taxes. If we sold it for $150,000, what would the tax be that's due? And once you have that number, my guess is that it's going to be, You have to recapture any depreciation that the accountant may have taken, and you've got to pay for that. But when all is said and done, if you could clear like 20 grand by selling this right now, you know, pay off the mortgage, pay the tax, pay the realtors, I think that's a good deal for you, because it doesn't sound like you really want to ultimately end up there. It doesn't sound like it's really working so great as a rental property. And it sounds like it's a total hassle. And so I would say this. I would think, even if you could just sell it and take some money out, beef up your savings, and not have to worry about it anymore, that sounds like a good outcome to me. So again, and everyone listening, if you've got rental property, the taxes on rental property when you sell it is different than the taxes if you sold your primary residence. So check with the accountant, find out what the number is, and then I think, Rosalba, it's time for you to move on. So I hope you have good luck with that. I hope that that unburdens you. And for anyone else who's got rental property, it's a very, it can be very lucrative to be a landlord. It can also be a complete drag. So I think nothing bad has happened here. Time for Rosalba to move on. All right. When we come back, more of your questions. It's Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
From rookie investors to savvy veterans, Jill Schlesinger is here to help you. Call now, 855-411-JILL, or email askjill@jillonmoney.com.
That's life. That's what all the people say. You're riding high in April, shot down in May.
You're back with Jill on Money. Thank you, Mark. That was a good one. This is the program that takes the mystery out of your financial life. 855-411-JILL. That is our phone number. Our email address, askjill@jillonmoney.com. Can't get enough of us? Check out our new podcast, Better Off Podcast. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts. iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud. Check it out. Cheryl writes, I am thinking of tapping my retirement account to pay for my daughter's tuition bill. Good? Bad? What do you think? You didn't mention how old you are, but let's presume that let's do it two scenarios. Let's say you're under 59 and a half, and so you're going to have to pay taxes. You may not have to pay a penalty. I mean, actually, I don't think you have to pay a penalty if it's for education expenses. So let's just presume that you're going to take the money out, you're going to pay your tax bill, and you're also going to pull money out of your retirement account. So generally speaking, I don't love that idea, but here's your caveat. Let's say you've got $2 million in your retirement account, and it really is the only money you have access to, and that's your pot of money. You're fully employed. You've got good financial planning going on. You know that you can reach your goals even pulling this money out. Yeah, maybe. Maybe a loan instead of a actual withdrawal could be better for you. However, let me go back and say that I doubt that you have $2 million in your retirement account. Why do I doubt that? Because if you're the kind of person who has $2 million in your 401k, you're probably also the kind of person who would have saved money outside of your retirement account for your college education bills. Now, I know what you're going to say. I don't want to burden my kid with student loans. So what do I want to say about that? I know that parents don't want to tell their kids that they can't pay for college, but the sooner you can do that, the better off it's going to be. And maybe if you're having conversations with your kids about your ability to pay tuition or contribute to their education earlier, that might shift the dialogue about which school they attend. This is too late. In your case, I get it. The kid's heading to school. But why not let your kid take on the debt and wait to see how things go, incent that, like, some good habits in college, and then maybe if things work out great, you help pay for college, the college loans back. I just think that what you may be thinking about today as, like, this gift to your kid may also hurt your own retirement planning, right? I just saw this, like, crazy statistic recently that the biggest group of people, the new group of people servicing college debt, baby boomers. Baby boomers, that's not their debt. There's no way that's their own debt. That's their kids' debt that they either co-signed for or they took a parent loan out for the kid. And I just think that that's bad practice. You've got to be able to take care of your own retirement first, which is why, generally speaking, I don't like tapping your retirement account to fund college. I just don't. And I think that it can put you in this weird place where you think you've done something really smart for your kid, for you, even if you make it tax efficient, however you decide to do that. And then later on, you're like, uh-oh, that $200,000 or $100,000 that I pulled out of my retirement account is no longer part of my retirement. I've taken it out of the account, and now I'm coming up short on my own retirement. That's a terrible game plan. And I don't know how to... I have been accused by some saying, like, well, you don't understand. You're not a parent. I am not a parent, but I do understand. I understand that my job is to protect you from doing something that's going to hurt yourself. Because if your financial situation is compromised, guess who has to take care of that? Your kid. Your own child is going to be burdened with that. And I just don't think you want to do that. So if anything, please, please try to be smart about how you look at college and what kind of teamwork you and your kids can have towards reaching the goal that you want, which is both of you want the kid to have a college degree. That does not mean that either of you or both of you has to go into debt or drain your retirement funds in order to make that happen. I just think that too many people are putting themselves in these dangerous situations. They didn't have to. So let's all, like, make a little pinky swear here. We're going to have more open and honest conversations earlier in our kids' lives so that we can actually be able to manage this process of college and get everyone where he or she needs to go without blowing up your retirement plan or creating a massive load of debt under which both of you are burdened. Okay? Thanks for the letter. You're listening to Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back. If I didn't think it was worth one single try, I'd jump right on a big bird and then I'd fly. I've been a puppet, a pauper, a pirate, a poet, a pawn and a king. I've been up and down and over and out, and I know one thing. You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, 855-411-JILL, or send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. Daniel writes, I am maxing out my retirement plan contribution. I have a little bit of money left over. What should I do? I make $115,000 a year. I'm single. I'm thinking about doing a little investing. What do you think? Mark is mouthing to me. Roth. He's right, Daniel. I don't know why people just... it's very funny. I don't know why people start saying, like, I'm going to buy an individual stock. I mean, even if you wanted to do that, which is a dopey thing to do because, you know, you're not going to pick the best individual stock. A Roth IRA is pretty delicious in terms of a way to a vehicle to use, right? So remember, there is absolutely a limit as to who can open and fund an account. Okay, so I think it's like 117 or 18,000 is the where it starts, but I'll have to look at that. But what's really amazing is you put money into a Roth. It grows without any tax. It's an after-tax dollar. It goes in. All right. So you put an after-tax dollar in. Oh, I was actually right. Single head of household, a modified adjusted gross income less than 118,000. You can put it in. Gets phased out between 118 and 133, and then you can't use it if you make more than $133,000. But you put the money after-tax dollar in. It's fantastic. It grows. It grows. It grows. And what happens when you take it out? No tax due. Gotta love that. I mean, even if you are one of those knuckleheads who wants to, you know, buy and sell individual stocks, I'd rather do it in a Roth than outside of a Roth. There's no tax event. So if you think you are smarter than the market and all the greats out there, drive yourself crazy, but do it inside of a Roth. Otherwise, just buy some index funds or use a robo-advisor and make yourself sleep at night. Okay? How about that? You're listening to Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.